And thus, this static, like I said, it was never a static faith, but now it was having to meet these historical circumstances in which it found itself. And it was having to adjust and adapt again because now they're building the temple. Or the temple actually had been in play for one or two generations of believers. And how do they go back to doing this? And how do they reintegrate this into their faith? Sadducees, they're seen as the liberals adapting to political currents, making alliances with those Gentile political forces, whereas the Pharisee scribes are seen as conservative, as more traditional, as wanting to codify and keep the old ways, but not really the old ways, just the old ways as they reinterpreted the old ways. So it's like the Republicans today in America. They say they're conservative, but really, they're not. And so they're keeping the old ways by adopting the new ways and just relabeling them. And that's what scribes and Pharisees are doing to some extent. Of course, Judaism had to be retaught. Most people hadn't been reading the scriptures. They'd had the stories, and they had gone to the synagogues that had developed in the Babylonian exile. But that was not the same as codifying what to do during a synagogue service. What prayers do you say? What songs do you sing? What's the point of it? What's the purpose? It's like if you're in an Anglican church, order service and is going to be very different than you're in a Baptist church, than if you're in a Pentecostal church, and so forth. And so rebuilding both the temple and Judaism, they had to clarify their faith in this new political environment. Remember, there's no monarchy. So the oral law becomes the vehicle for practice and interpretation of the previous scriptures, of the written scriptures. And this is going to be a problem because now the oral scriptures, which really aren't scriptures, the oral law, takes precedence over the written law. And that's the way it's been ever since. They'll go back and they'll look at the law and they'll honor the law and they'll take the scrolls and march around the synagogue every Saturday and worship the scrolls. But they don't practice them. They practice the oral law. That is what determines their practice of faith. So these develop into traditions and customs that Christ criticized in the Gospels. Now, by and large, most Gentiles, most Christians are not understanding much of the Talmud. So really don't have a good grasp of these customs and traditions and things that Christ is criticizing. And it's difficult to go back and do it because those editions of the Talmud that have been written in your language have been sanitized. And so we tend to not understand how the Jews viewed themselves in relationship to Gentiles, to others. I guess a rough rule of thumb is that since Islam copied the Jews to a large extent, and Islam sees themselves superior to everyone else, that's kind of how the Jews saw themselves in relationship to everybody else. They were superior. They could do pretty much whatever they wanted and not be punished. But if anyone did things to them, they could be punished severely, so on and so forth. If you go back and read these, you would be astonished. Yeah. They're just disgusting, a lot of them. And these are the things that Christ was addressing, not in specifics, but he was addressing them in a broad brush, and everyone of his day knew what he was referring to, but people of today have not a clue what he's talking about. We just think we do. Oh, they have a tradition. They go to church on Saturday rather than Sunday, and Christ is criticizing them. No, it's much worse than that. It's their whole attitude their whole way of life and looking at others. Jonah is a quintessential Jew, which made him such a terrible missionary. He was not unusual. And he was before the exile. He was even before the exile of the northern kingdom. So that was still early on, when this oral tradition was not really full-blown yet. This was their opinion of everyone else. They were the chosen ones, and everyone else, too bad. So imagine the religious cacophony or noise of their day. You have all these influences. You have all these various sects, and you have all of this knowledge percolating around and clashing and cascading, and you have people who have various interpretations of the scripture. Actually, you have today. It would be just like today, only the trappings would be different. They wouldn't be driving cars with cell phones and stuff, sitting around in modern attire and air conditioning, wondering about the state of their faith. They'd be sitting around, reclining around tables, moaning about the state of their faith. In fact, what we believe, well, we know the scripts say the only legitimate temple is the one in Jerusalem. But it seems like that during the Babylonian captivity, they actually had built one in Persia, in a place known as the Elephantine. And actually they had a temple there, and there's a document where this temple, around 407 BC, is writing back to Jerusalem, asking for help in rebuilding it. Now, Jerusalem had already rebuilt the temple, and they didn't want a competing temple, so they just ignored the letter again and again. And so the priesthood was functioning in some sense, but not a legitimate sense. And they're no longer the sole authority on implementation of the law in daily life. If you go back to the Pentateuch, you'll see it is the priesthood that determines if you're clean or unclean, if you have leprosy or cure of leprosy, if your wife is cheating or not cheating, if you're lying or not lying. And because they're occupying these various towns throughout the kingdom, they're the go-to people in your neighborhood, in your town, to settle disputes and stuff. So you have, it's like a lower court, and then by the time you get to Jerusalem at the temple, you're at the Supreme Court, to put it in a context most Americans can grasp. But now they're no longer the sole authority on Scripture, because, you know, you have the scribes and Pharisees who have developed this body of knowledge, and the people are following this. And thus you have this struggle, this pull for power, not only political power and social power, but also for religious authority. And priesthood pretty much is being regulated to the temple's sacrificial rites. And they're going to have a problem with them, because that is not what the scriptures teach, but that is what they've had to adjust and adapt to. It is the great synagogue, which is basically the Pharisees and the scribes, who are determining civil life and practice. Remember, Ezra was the leader of it, the scribe? Well, they're not going to be inviting many priests into that. The priesthood are regulated to doing the temple thing. And so they have to find another base of power, and they do. They're very ingenious. But for the life and practice of the people, they're looking to this new sect that they grew up with in Babylon. Because there was no priesthood except maybe at the Elephantine temple, and I'm not sure how convenient it was to go there. So you have the religious texts, the liturgy, and the practice was defined by these scholars. not by the priesthood. And the oral law gained ascendancy over the Torah, competing with priestly authority and Judaistic life and practice. And we see this occurring in the church age, where people were just following the epistles, they were following some aspect of Judaism, but as Jews became less and less and less in the church, like in the book of Acts, and Gentiles became more and more and more, the whole character and flavor of looking at the scriptures changed. And when the later on, it changes dramatically, and we'll talk about that in a moment. So the priesthood then joins with the Samaritans, consolidating dynastic power in the Inter Testament period. And we tend not to grasp that there was this political power that had grown up in the land while they were gone, while their hierarchy was gone. Now that they've come back, they have to compete with this political power that filled that vacuum and does not want to contract to allow them back in. Much like we see today in Israel and Palestine area, where the Jews, before the UN, founded them or legitimized them as a nation and gave them a set amount of territory. There was a political system in place. And one day, that system was in place in Israel, and the next day, it was not in place in Israel. And people just don't adjust well to losing power. The flesh never wants to lose power. It wants to hang on to power at any cost. And so the priesthood basically despise their duty. Now, this is exactly what God is talking about. He puts in Malachi's mouth this dialogue, and it's a very unique way and a good way of approaching a problem. In fact, we see Paul using this approach in the book of Romans, where Paul will ask a question and then he'll answer it, which raises another question that he asks. And then he answers, because that's how we think. We're thinking those questions. We just haven't asked them yet. So he asks the very obvious question, then turns around and answers it. So as Malachi starts off in verse 6, he said, "A son honors his father, and a slave his master. If then I am a father, where's my honor? And if I am a master, where's my fear? Says the Lord of hosts to you, O priests who have despised my name. But you say, how have we despised your name?" In other words, he knows their thoughts, and he tells them their thoughts. He says, "This is my accusation against you." Well, how have we done that? Have you ever brought an accusation to someone, husband, wife, child, teacher? And the first words out of their mouth, "Well, how have I done that? I haven't done that." Well, yeah, you have. You can redefine it to put any term on it you want, but that doesn't change the basic fact that yes, you have done this, and that's what God is telling them here. This is what you've done. Well, how have we done that? We haven't done that. See, we're slaughtering the animals. We're doing all this. We're doing everything we're supposed to do. Well, no, you're not, because you're offering unclean animals. Remember, the animals were not to have any blemish on the outside nor the inside. The whole reason for flaying them open and examining them. And yet that's not what's happening. They're offering unclean animals. Animals that you could not sell on the open market. So they were selling them to the temple so people could buy them as their sacrifice. Those the priests were blessing that which they're supposed to be rejecting. And so they basically saw this as a very unimportant aspect of their duties. Okay, my turn. Today I got a slaughter. And that's what you do all day. Slit, splash, flay, burn. Slit, splash, flay, burn. Slit, splash, flay, burn. And that's what you do all day. Probably seems like a very unimportant part of your duty there. This base of ritual of animal slaughter was probably beginning to appear pointless to them. Remember, they had for 70 years or so been exposed to Zoroastrianism, which is a very spiritualistic type of faith. There is no sacrificial system style. There is only goodness through thinking. And later on, you're going to have Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism, and Hinduism, which is pretty much going to take that same route, though Hinduism does have some sacrificial elements. Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism, these do not. They're very, very spiritual, very what we call otherworldly. And so what you're doing once you've been exposed to that probably seems pretty disgusting. If we were to go back and look at the animal sacrifices actually being performed, we'd probably think, that's pretty disgusting. I don't want to do that. I mean, it smells. It's if you've ever been around animals who are slaughtered, who have been flayed open, it's just terrible. You're just not used to it. And so it was probably beginning to seem very pointless to them. Remember, their power, they had power. And here is where you have to understand the cultural basis. They had political power because they were the ones that were the political, religious structure of the temple. And the Gentiles, they understood that. I can deal with one person, I can understand that. Then that one person can deal with the rest of the culture. And so the high priest became that political entity that most of the Gentiles interacted with. Thus, it was the high priest who became the tax collector. Now we see that a little different in the Gospels because Rome had a different approach to a certain extent. And thus, even though during this period, the intertestament period in here, the high priesthood was still hereditary, it was not always hereditary because it was seen as a political office more than a religious office. The rulers could, and occasionally did, take one person out from being high priest and install another one that would collect the taxes better or maintain the order better and do what the king wanted them to do. The Romans were very good about that. They held the high priest's garments in ransom. And so if the high priest wanted to practice high priest on the high holy days, he had to kowtow to their will. And one year it might be Ananias would be high priest, next year it would be Caiaphas, and so they would dole it out as they wanted, depending on who was going to do their will. The Romans were very good about that. And so here we see the Sadducees and the priesthood. These are the power elites. These are the ones who are most interactive with the Gentiles. Thus, that's why they seem the most liberal, because they're taking on the coloration of the societies in which they're interacting with. And they're beginning to own the farms and the land around Jerusalem, and the farmers who are working it are those who can't pay their taxes. Thus, they're now tied to the land. This is a type of serfdom that we're going to encounter later on in Rome, that then, because the Romans did it, it becomes the pattern that exists throughout the medieval period and was only started to be rejected in the 1700s, 1800s. That's where their power came from. I don't want to mistake that they didn't have any power. They had a lot of power, but they were not performing the duties that they were supposed to perform. Much of that had been co-opted by the scribes and Pharisees, and what was left for them to do was just mundane, and thus they weren't taking it very seriously. So the priesthood was aligned with political forces for power. Their temple duties were very insignificant to them. and its lackadaisical approach revealed their lack of faith in God. Thus, the people looked elsewhere for guidance. Not only that, as we know from the Gospels, they began charging higher and higher rates for the sacrifices and changing the coins and getting their cut of the pay, and just people were just becoming once again disgusted with the priesthood and not following them and rejecting God because of them. Now, the scribes and the Pharisees define piety, but they define it by works, based on reason. Remember the false premise that Satan gave to the woman. You're not God because you don't have enough knowledge, but if you have enough knowledge, then you can be as God. And man has always operated from that false premise ever since. If we have enough knowledge, then we have power. We can do more. We can be as God. And thus the scribes and the Pharisees held that out to the people, not maliciously, honestly, but they were wrong, honestly. Now, there were malicious uses made of it. Not all the Pharisees were judging correctly. They could be bribed, and they could pervert the truth for their own ends, and certainly they were not above, like any other political entity, adjusting the truth to fit their particular agenda at that moment in time. We don't want to make them out to be innocent, but we don't want to make them out to be totally guilty. They were adjusting and adapting to changes in their culture, and but they had lost their way. God was not their first love. God was not their focus. Now it became, how do we live and maintain our culture and maintain our identity? And we're going to do it around this law, but not to see Jesus, not to see eternal life. And we're not going to allow anyone to come in and upset this so that this is destroyed and we become dispersed and we lose our identity. Thus, that's why they rejected Christ, one of the reasons. And the common people could never be part of the priesthood. It's dynastic. It's passed down father to son, and that's codified in the law in Exodus. You had to be of the tribe of Aaron. But common people could be righteous by following the rules of the Pharisees. Anybody could do that. Thus, there was hope for them. Now, before we condemn them, this is exactly what Christians teach. Anyone can be saved. Anyone can learn the Bible. Anyone can follow the truth of God. And thus, the Pharisees had a good idea. They just had a bad implementation. Because their whole focus then became on, I live a certain way based on these rules. And whenever you start doing that, you lose sight of why you had the rules. What are they based on? The rules become all important, and the whole reason that you had the rules to begin with is lost sight of, and thus you cannot adjust, adapt, or overcome. So the people end up with no more faith than before the exile. They just didn't have idolatry in that sense. There was this faithfulness. There was no faithfulness to the faith in God. They had just lost it. By and large, now there were individuals that didn't. The individuals kept it. There's always a remnant. So the people changed, but not in faith that God had control. They'd lost the monarchy. Yes, they came back to the land, but they're not in control. And we have these Gentiles that can tell them what to do, and these exorbitant taxes. And they're in a very small land. It's only 35 miles by 35 miles. It's a tiny land. It's surrounded by hostile kingdoms. And later on, after the time of Malachi, you're going to have these interactions between the Ptolemies and Seleucids. And their battles usually take place in the Palestine area. And then the Romans are going to be invited in, and they're not going to leave. And their battles take place there. And the trade routes are going there. And it's just constant influx of change after change after change, with Hellenistic influences and later Roman influence, and you just feel like you're going to lose everything. So they felt that they were at the mercy of the Gentile world, and the promises of God seemed irrelevant, if not impossible, and the pointless rituals for ignorant people and a non-existent God. That's how the priesthood felt. These things are pointless, and the people are ignorant, and God really doesn't exist. We just slaughter animals to slaughter animals. Because if the promises of God were true, they'd be here. But since they haven't happened, they're not real. Does that sound like today? So God confronts the priesthood through Malachi. And he does it on two levels. God is Father and God is Lord. He's both. He's Father to the nation. He brought them into existence. He chose Abraham. He caused Sarai to be pregnant with Isaac, the laughter. Because she could not have gotten pregnant otherwise, and she never had children. He opened up her womb. He is the father of the nation. Thus, he was due obedience because he was father. They were taught to respect the patriarch, to respect the father, to respect the head of the family. They didn't always do that, but that's what they were taught, that's what they believed, and that's what they generally practiced. He says, I'm the father. Where is my respect? Well, if you don't want to talk about it on that level, let's talk about it on the other level. I'm Lord. And if I'm Lord, where's my fear? Why are you not in reverent awe? Since I am creator of the universe, and I am creator of all you have, and I am the one that you depend on daily for breathing and eating and life and everything. Why do you not fear me? Why? Because they don't really believe in him. It's like most people who sit in churches today. They really don't believe in him. They just do it because that's what they do. So they reject him on both these levels, as evidenced by their polluted sacrifices that violated the written Torah. Now, what do these sacrifices represent? Why was any of this important? Well, the sacrificial system became a means of getting rid of these, like I said earlier, these unsaleable animals, probably. You're not going to be able to sell them off for their hides, because they're blemished or whatever, or they have cancers and tumors, and no one wants to eat their meat. You got these animals, you just can't do anything with, and they're eating, so you're having to watch them, and you're losing money on them. And you can't sell them, so you can't cut your loss. Well, wait a minute, I can sell them to the temple. I can get some money for these. And then the temple sells them off to the people who wanted animals for sacrifices. They had to be special blessed animals. The priesthood controlled that trade, so they made money on it. Thus, it became another scheme for making money. Now, it's not saying that making money is wrong or evil. The Bible doesn't say that. But the love of money is, and thus they were doing this because they did not believe or understand what the sacrificial system was about. Because, see, the animal sacrifices represented Christ. And Christ is without sin, both inside and outside. He did not sin in the flesh. He had no hidden sin. And he was examined exhaustively, both during his public ministry as well as the last 24 hours of life, being flayed and beaten and hung on the cross. That was just the examination period. Only the last 3 hours did he pay the price for sin. All that other time was examination to see if he was without sin, if he was going to be appropriate to be the sacrifice. But if you offer a polluted sacrifice and you're saying Christ is sinful, well, if he's sinful, if he's unclean, if he has blemish, he's not a sacrifice for sin. In other words, God has lied to you. God has tricked you. God cannot be depended on. And you have despised Christ. And Hebrews, the book Hebrews in the New Testament, talks about this. If you've come to know and understand about Christ, but then you say, I need another sacrifice for sin other than Christ, you put his death to an open shame. You said it's not enough. You say, God is sinful. And thus you despise that. And that's exactly what they were doing. So this, their lack of faith in God's promises of a coming Messiah and a future glorification of Israel. They wanted what they wanted now. Welcome to humanity. That's how we all think. So God asked them how their governors or kings would react to receiving such tokens from their hands. I mean, God talks to them eye to eye, shoulder to shoulder, pulls no punches. Said, well, go give these animals to your king or your governor. How do you think they're going to like it? Now, these people knew better than to do that. Of course, that would not work out well for them. So why do you do it to me? They were destroying God's message of salvation via the sacrificial system, showing the and see, this was the problem. The sacrificial system and the Torah were to go out among the nations, reproving them of their sin, talking to them of God's holiness, and instructing them in the mechanism that God was putting in place so that God and man could come together in a righteous relationship based on the sacrifice of a righteous God who would pay their penalty for sin. But this message was being totally destroyed again. It kind of gets destroyed throughout the Old Testament, and God has to keep rebuilding it. God says the Gentiles are going to have more respect for, in fact, what is implied here is that the Gentiles had more respect for their idols, for their gods, than the Jews had for God himself. And that's just a sad commentary. They're doing this because they feel they have to. Yet God says, my name is great. I really don't need you guys. I chose you guys. I went and developed a relationship with you guys. But I don't need you. I chose you. But my name is going to be great among the Gentiles anyway. Now, this is true. When Christ rose from the grave and gave his apostles the commission, and the church was born, and the gospel message went out, and it's still going out around the world, that's making his name great among the Gentiles. In fact, in Romans 11 and 12, it says this drives the Jews crazy, and it's supposed to, because today they still reject their Meshua. They still reject God's offer of salvation. Now, there are individual Jews who are saved who become Christians, such as Paul, and even today. So he will save, he mean God will save whom he will save, in spite of their rejection. And he is also speaking of the millennial kingdom period. We talked about that in the book of Zechariah several times. They just don't see it happening. They don't believe it's going to happen. They expected it to happen when they came back to the land, and it didn't. It was hard work. And they expected it to happen when they built the second temple, and it kind of didn't. And that was hard work. And then they had to build the wall. And that was dangerous work. And it still didn't happen. So it probably isn't going to happen. So why are we doing this? So they're rebuilding a Judaism that excludes God that exists today even. And Judaism never recovers from this. So God remains excluded from their religion, their faith. I mean, they give lip service to him, but no power. And thus he has excluded them from his salvation as a group. Like I said, individuals are always being saved. These are the false Jews who collude with the political powers for the goals, whatever their perceived goals are. But in the end, we see that they're going to be consumed by the Antichrist and such. And only the true Jews who come to knowledge of him during the tribulation period will call upon him and accept him as their Meshua and mourn for him who their people, their forefathers, had pierced. Well, Christians are no different. The sinful human nature is the same regardless of the institution. And the Christians have despaired of Christ ever coming again. I mean, they were despairing almost after he left, certainly during Paul's day. And the Christians have sought political power and alliances to shape the world to their purposes. History is nothing more than the futility of Judaism, Christendom, and Gnosticism warring against God, demonstrating their lack of faith. So we're conflating Christianity, and today we conflate Christianity and patriotism. We say they're both the same. If you're patriotic, you have to be a Christian. Man, Christians must always be patriotic. Except we have a problem here. Patriotism is blind obedience to the wants and needs of the government, which has its own agenda. It's not run by Christ. There is no theocracy. It is a tool of Satan. And thus, we live under it. And as long as we can obey the scriptures and live moral lives, we do so no matter what government we find ourselves under. But neither do we follow the government blindly and allow ourselves to be co-opted to do evil. Especially as Peter told the Sanhedrin in the book of Acts, he says, we're going to have to obey God on this. I know you told us not to teach the gospel anymore, but as you know, we need to be doing what God tells us to do. And if it means you beat us again, well, that's what it means. And Paul, who never spoke a word against the Empire of Rome, who never countenanced rebellion, always preached the gospel, was beheaded by Rome for preaching the gospel. Still, he did right. And that's what we are to do. We're not to conflate these two concepts together and worship the nation. We worship God and we worship him alone. Because patriotism is the main mechanism by which the nation legitimizes its wars with other nations. So since the Enlightenment, man has sought to define the world without God. He's used evolution, both biological and geological are the two main arms. He's used atheism, and he's used postmodernism, if we were to borrow the end point of philosophy today. You know, even science, our understanding of knowledge, is co-opted against God. Science originally was a methodology to discover absolute truth of the natural world. Like, that's what they were trying to do. And very quickly, they began to understand that they could not do that. And so now they've ended up saying, well, we're not really trying to define absolute truth. We're just trying to see how things work, kind of, if we can. Except we've gone to the point today where now we've taken this, quote-unquote, search for knowledge, science, and we've twisted and perverted it to where we're using it to support pseudoscience or false philosophies or errors. And thus, we've taken this search for knowledge and we've made it a search for lies. And we've tried to pit it against God, saying, well, now, if you have faith in the Bible, then you must hate knowledge. And if you love knowledge, then you're going to reject this fairy tale faith that people have in the Bible. So this false knowledge is no different than the idolatries of the ancient world. So rather than accepting the truth of God, man rejects the knowledge of God, showing himself to be foolish. In other words, once again, we've come back to Romans 1, 18 through 32. We must always end up there. And then we see the churches corrupting themselves. During the medieval period, the Roman Catholic Church which grew out of this unholy union between the Church of Rome and Constantine, who co-opted it and used it to further his power. And it grew and morphed into the Roman Catholic Church, then split off to the Greek Orthodox also. They were nothing more than extensions of the nation, of the political state. And same way with the Protestant churches, very quickly, when they broke away from Catholicism, came co-opted by nation states, both for their own protection and to legitimize the nation state, and thus corrupting themselves. And they would turn around and persecute those who disagreed with them. And evangelical churches today join various political movements and incorporate pseudosciences, psychology, and this other mess into the movements, which is destroying their gospel message. In other words, we haven't changed. We're exactly the same. So what can we do? Study the scriptures. Use a normative hermeneutical method of understanding the scriptures, and remember that God has his plan, like we talked about in the last lesson, the Mandelbrot. No matter what level you look at, with the very macro or the very micro level, the will of God is exactly the same. It will accomplish the purpose of God. And we are a small part of that at this point in time, and we have to have faith that God will do what he says he will do. Otherwise, what are you doing? What's the whole point? Because if you're going through all of this, just because you think that you're going to be praised, that's worthless. That's works. You're lost. Nobody goes through this, the persecution, the isolation, the ostracism, unless you have faith that this will work, that this is God and he's doing what he says he will do. Now, I don't understand the overall plan. Nobody does, because we don't have that infinite understanding. But I understand my part in it. And it's to teach the word as best I can as I understand it, and try and live the word as best I can, recognizing I fail constantly, and pray so that his strength will flow through me. And at some point when I stand before him, I will be found acceptable because he lives within me. Thank you.